corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, which, by the way, is a listener-supported station, radiopower.org, and they're having a fundraiser right now. They could use your support. Go to radiopower.org and help out, participate. And whiterosesociety.org, which is also a listener-supported site and also always in need of support. Also, you can find archives of this program at whiterosesociety.org, as well as our podcast there and on Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free across the United States. Outside the United States, area code 503-248-0620. And China is doing what George Bush could have done. And this is mind-boggling. Here, George W. Bush just signed this energy bill, and he came before us and he said, "Oh, we got to sign this energy bill. It's a wonderful thing. Is it going to help us?" Well, it's not going to help anything other than George Bush's buddies in Texas. I mean, it's going to help out his oil buddies. That's it. But in China, get this. This is from China Daily. This is not the New York Times, not the Washington Post. No, the American press is largely ignoring this story. This is from the China Daily. A government Dateline Shanghai. A government-funded project to turn the city's roofs, into sites for solar energy production will soon be submitted for final approval. If the project becomes operational, 100,000 of the 6 million roofs in Shanghai, a city plagued by chronic power shortages, will be used to supply solar energy to local residents, revealed Professor Cui Wangyang, director of the Institute for Solar Energy at Shanghai's Zhongtong University and the head of the project over the weekend. According to Cui, the selected rooftops will be equipped with a system that is able to convert sunlight into electricity by the end of 2015. Crystalline solar cells inset onto large boards that turn sunlight into solar energy will be linked to the building's cables, which will then transmit electricity to the power grid. Now get the numbers on this thing. It's estimated that the 100,000 roofs, keep in mind, this is just a trial. The 100,000 roofs will be able to generate 430 million kilowatt hours of electricity every year. 430 million kilowatt hours. That's 430 billion hours. 430 million thousand watt hours, kilowatt hours. And last summer, the peak daily power consumption was 300 million kilowatt hours. If it works well, said Cui, the system will be applied more widely. All of the current 200 million square meters of rooftops could produce 28.6 billion kilowatts of power, as each square meter is capable of giving out 143 kilowatts per hour. And it's just amazing. Here, China is doing this, and the United States is not. We're ignoring this. And what's the investment going to be? It's about $18,000 per roof. So 18,000 times 100,000 roofs, about $1.8 million. George Bush couldn't even come up with that in the energy bill. No, all of the money had to go to his fat cat friends in the oil industry. Cindy Sheehan is still camped out at Camp Casey across from George Bush's hobby farm down there, his hobby so-called ranch. He's afraid of horses, so I'm reluctant to call it a ranch, but it was a pig farm. When he bought it in 2000, decided to run for president, decided he should trade in his apartment. Boy from Andover, the prep school young man, born in Connecticut, and try to pretend he's a Texan. And so anyhow, across the street or down the road from them, Cindy Sheehan is there. She's not feeling so well. Celeste Zapala, is it pronounced Zapala? Do I have it right, Celeste?
Yes, you do.
Okay, great. Celeste Zapala is with us. Celeste is the co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, GSFP.org, and, of course, the meetwithcindy.org, a new website in support of Cindy and Celeste and the work that you all are doing. And, Celeste, you lost your son in Iraq as well.
Yes, my son, Sergeant Sherwood Baker, was killed on April the 26th last year. He was from the Pennsylvania National Guard, and he was the first guardsman killed since World War II He was actually killed protecting the Iraq Survey Group. They were the people who were still looking for the weapons of mass destruction.
And this was about the time that George Bush was making jokes about
looking
under his desk?
Yes, actually a month later. And I just really put that together recently, that that's the timing of it, that he said that on March 24th of last year, and Sherwood was dead on April the 26th, looking for those weapons that he thought were so funny. It's all appalling. It's all tragic, and just today I've learned that there's another Philadelphia National Guardsman who's been killed. It's just heartbreaking. And probably by the time I speak with you, there will be an Iraqi dead because of this war. I mean, it's just, the killing goes on and on and on, and I think that we're in a crisis. You know, I think this war is a crisis. I think that the president ought to be spending all of his time trying to figure out how to end it. It just distresses me so much, kind of a cavalier attitude towards the losses. And if he could see the people we see, you know my families and our other families in Gold Star Families for Peace and military families speak out. We've got people joining us who are have loved ones who are serving now in Iraq, mm-hmm. or who somehow made it home, and we've got Iraq veterans who are standing with us. I mean, my thought is that we are reasonable, patriotic people. Listen to us. You know, unfortunately, the president seems to listen to only to people who agree with him. So please listen to the people who don't agree with you. You know, listen to the people who have given all they can give, and who love their country, and let us talk together so that we can try to find a way out of this. I just think that you know, I'm a very religious person, so I come at this from a religious position, that we are called to try to be peacemakers, to try to do justice, to try to love mercy, and how can we do that? How can we draw the wisdom of the human family together to try to figure out how to solve this terrible crisis that's going on in the Middle East? Obviously, bombing, killing, blowing things up doesn't solve it for anybody. There has to be a better way.
Yeah, and George Bush apparently is not willing to consider that, although it looks like with the elections coming in November of 2006 that he will magically declare victory and come home. I'm predicting he's going to draw down our troops to just enough to cover our military bases there to protect the oil fields.
Yeah, but, you know, the question is, why are we building permanent military bases? I guess people need to be thinking about that, too.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of money going into permanent military bases.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people are asking that question, and I would say that Dick Cheney has already answered that question when he said...
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
I mean, there you got it.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney before the war.
Right. So, I mean, you know, I think that's part of our quest for the truth is, you know, having the administration acknowledge that they wanted this war to happen long before they took office. You know, this was a plan. This was a war they desired. And they needed to find a reason to have it. And that becomes more evident all the time. You know, the Downing Street memo, the 9/11 commission says there is no link to 9/11. And we need to stop, you know what I mean? We just have to get honest. How can we get to peace if we can't even be honest about what brought us to this point?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I hope to raise with people. And I know that there's a lot of controversy and discussion, but let's not lose the fact that no matter what we all say, our kids are still dead. We don't want any more kids to be dead. I don't want any more Iraqi children to die. I don't want more villages to be destroyed. We have to have a conversation that gets us to a conclusion of peace, not just some way to keep bickering and picking at each other, you know?
I agree. We're talking with Celeste Zappala. She is the co-founder, along with Cindy Sheehan, of Gold Star Families for Peace. Cindy Sheehan is not feeling well today. They are both there at Camp Casey, down the road from George W. Bush's hobby farm in Crawford, Texas. Celeste, Jennifer in Fort Worth, Texas, is driving a truck and wanted to say a few words to say hi to you. Is that all right?
Okay. Well, sure.
Hey, Jennifer, you're live and on with Celeste.
Hi. We love your show. My husband and I are truck drivers, and we just wanted to call and let you know that we got a little ahead of our load, and we decided that we wanted to cruise down to Crawford, Texas, and help support Cindy and everyone. And we called the Bill Press Show this morning and just mentioned it. And there was an onslaught of callers, truckers coming down. And I just wanted to let you know. And
Any coming should understand that Crawford is a really, really little town.
Yeah, about a population of about 300.
Right, and the roads are actually incredibly narrow.
Drop your trailers.
They are very narrow roads. It's a very tight little place. There's not really, I should just say that there's hardly any place to park at the campsite. So, people should really consider that if they're planning to come. There's a place called the Crawford Peace House, which is right in the center of Crawford, the town. And that might be a good place to land for a couple minutes. But, trucks out at the site would be, I think, almost impossible.
Okay.
So you should know that, all right?
Jennifer, I know you'll figure out a way to make that work. I appreciate the call. Thanks.
Sure will.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Skip in Las Vegas, New Mexico, or Nevada has a minute. We only have about a minute and a half left here before we have to take a break. Skip in Las Vegas. You're live with Celeste Zapala.
Hi, Celeste. Are you down in with Cindy right now?
Yes, Cindy's in the same place I am, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I heard a little blip. I listened to 143 on Sirius all day long, and I heard that the government or the police down there have sharpshooters trained on your site.
I don't think so.
See, I'm just wondering if you've heard anything about that because...
No, actually, the police have been... The sheriffs and stuff have been accommodating.
Right.
You know, at first we thought we might...
Tomorrow.
Yeah, I understand that. And who knows, you know, I mean, I can just tell you what I know is that they've sort of stepped back from their threat to arrest us. We are absolutely nonviolent people committed to nonviolence. We are no threat to anybody. And our job here is to tell the truth. We're not out to frighten anyone. We just want to stand here and tell the truth. And so I'm not afraid. I'm a citizen, a mother of a fallen soldier. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm here to speak up for my son and all of the, it must be 1,840 now who we've lost. I'm speaking for them. I'm speaking for the dead kids.
I have to say,
families.
Though, Celeste, you're trying to tell the truth. As George Orwell said, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Well, I believe that, too.
Yeah, and so I honor you. You are in my prayers.
Thank you so much.
And that of those of our listeners, our thoughts, our good vibes, you know, whatever people are, you know, whatever their personal belief system may be, we're with you. You and Cindy and all of you down there. Celeste Zapala, thanks so much for the great work you're doing. And we'll keep mentioning it on this program. Celeste
Zapala. Okay, God bless you.
Thanks very much.
And
bye-bye. You too. Bye now. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Harbin.
Come, writers and critics, you prophesize with your pen. And keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming.
You see, the times are changing.
The loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing.
And I can tell you that the Bushies, they are clueless. They just don't get it. People are waking up. People are waking up to their lies. People are waking up to their spin. People are waking up to the fact that they are trying to steal this nation for what Thomas Jefferson referred to as the well-born and well-bred, exclusively trying to create a middle class that is desperate and working, you know, as hard as it can just to keep its head above water. They have spent our country into debt, that they are bankrupting our educational system, that they're destroying our infrastructure, that they have sold out our industry to China and other third world countries so that multinational corporations and their good buddies who run them can get richer and richer and richher at the expense of the average American working person, that we and destroying our industrial infrastructure. The energy bill, we're going to make a great investment in energy by what? Giving more money to Halliburton. Are we going to put solar panels on the roofs of 100,000 houses for $1.8 million? That's the cost of about 48 seconds in Iraq. Are we going to do that just to see, you know, what might happen? Is it possible that we could make self-sufficient community? Of course! In at least half the United States, solar power alone could provide 100% of our needs. All the, you know, everything south of the Mason-Dixon line, and north of that, you could do it with wind power. No, the Bush administration says we wouldn't want to do that. That would create an economic boom, just like the computer revolution, and then you'd have lots of people and great jobs, and new industries would be birthed, and we can't have that. We're trying to destroy this country! I'm telling you, I am becoming increasingly convinced that George W. Bush was the Manchurian candidate, that the Bush family, that the whole New World Order that George Bush Sr. talked about, that Reagan brought along, is all about destroying the United States. And it's taken me a long time to come to that conclusion, but I can't come up with any other answer. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Karen in New York City on the line. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to give, of course, unwavering support and prayers for the mothers of lost men and, of course, all soldiers still serving, and tell them that if anyone ever gets a chance to see Mr. Bush in person, they should walk in with a copy of either Prelude to Terror or The Spider's Web, because there's no backing away from that. He would just absolutely... I don't know what he'd do. We have an opportunity to educate ourselves about how this all came to be. I don't think anyone should, speak to Republicans or anyone else unless they have this book in their possession.
Well, even going beyond those books, you know, and certainly George W. Bush, I mean, you know, there was a tragedy recently, you know, his library burned and both of the books are gone, and one of them he hadn't finished coloring is the old joke, right? But even at that, I mean, today in the paper was the story about how the military apparently was tracking Mohammed Atta and three other guys. And I mean, you know, George Bush had 56 memos telling him that these guys were determined to strike inside the United States, that they were coming to get us. What does he do? He goes on vacation, the longest vacation in the history of the presidency. He's doing French vacation. You know, the French are required by law to have 5 weeks of vacation a year. That's what Ronald Reagan did. That's what George W. Bush is doing. 5 weeks of vacation a year. Maybe they're the French candidates, not the Manchurian candidates. But anyhow, I don't think he would have to read it, Karen, because I think he already knows it.
Well, the thing is, I think that every voter should read it, because it was such an awakening to me to see how long, far back, and how deep this goes. Because, frankly, if we don't stand up and force our news people to say, for example, I'm writing Chris Matthews, and I'm going to say, hey, Chris, the next time you interview somebody from the White House, why don't you just go out of this book and say, you know what, now that we have 100% proof that all of these other wars were contrived,
but Chris
by
Matthews
CIA
voted for Bush. But Chris Matthews on the air brags about the fact that he voted for George Bush.
Well, this is true. But I'm telling you, if more people, if he got 10 emails a day saying, look, Chris, we're onto this whole Bush family scheme, you better start asking questions or we're going to call you a repeater, not a reporter.
Yeah, well, good one. In fact, Karen, yeah, good one. Excellent, excellent name for him. Thank you so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. We've got to take a break here. We'll be back. I also want to get back to the energy thing, and the economy is supposed to be wonderful. We'll talk about that. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
To lie takes a liar, it's to steal takes a thief. To lie to the whole world takes a liar in chief. He lies and he lies and he lies. He lies and he lies and he lies.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful. And so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The Chinese are in the city of Shanghai going to put solar panels on the roofs of 100,000 homes, generating millions of kilowatts of power, just to see what happens. How does it work out? Yeah, it's $18,000 a house to set it up. And once it's installed, it'll work for 30 to 35 years, they say. No more investment necessary. Unlike burning coal or power or gas or even natural gas or oil, produces no pollution. And but here in the United States, nah, we can't do that. I'm sorry, you know, that doesn't produce profits for Dick Cheney. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Don in Stockton, California on the line. Hey, Don, thanks for listening. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for being on the air. You know, right now it's a timely thing that you're talking about the energy situation, because the on a link of the Solar Energy Industry Association.org.
Yes, sir.
There is a program. There is a meeting, a worldwide alternative energy meeting going on in Florida, if it isn't already over with. I just heard about it, but I haven't. And there are people from all over the world that are talking about their successes in alternative energy. And
oh, yeah. You know, the biggest problem that the solar industry is having in the United States right now, I spoke last year at Solfest, you know, the big convention here out here in California.
Right.
And you know, I know some people in the business. And the biggest problem that the solar energy industry in the United States is having right now is getting enough solar panels to meet demand. And the reason why is because other countries, most notably Germany and Finland, but a few other countries as well, but those two have really taken the lead, are offering substantial tax credits, tax breaks, incentives to companies and to individual homes to install solar power. And it has created just a, you know, the virtually all of the worldwide production of photovoltaic panels is now being sucked up by European countries, and it's hard to get them here in the United States. And, you know, the good news, I guess, of that is that, you know, eventually, you know, a year or two, some entrepreneur in America is going to get the forehead slap and say, hey, I can make some money doing this and build a factory. The bad news is probably that that will be, you know, they'll immediately be squashed like a bug or bought up by some, you know, by big, some big corporation like General Electric, and their factory will be moved to Shanghai. So anyhow,
yeah, a lot of that technology was invented, you know, at the taxpayers' expense.
Oh yeah, during the Jimmy
Carter
administration.
Yeah, and they came up with all this new technology, and they were assembling, they were using the Mexican workers to do the finish soldering and assembly of the panels, but I don't even know if we can find those anymore.
Yeah,
because they're being bought up, or the company was maybe sold, and they took the machinery all the way to China or something.
Yeah, and I think that it's so important. When George Bush gave his little speech, you know, about, hey, please pass the energy bill, he was saying, and Don, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from
okay.
you. Jimmy Carter was, Bill Clinton. George W. Bush was going on and on about it. We don't have an energy policy in the United States. We've never had an energy policy. It's time for us to have an energy policy. Excuse me, sir, on the 15th of July, 1979, President of the United States, Jimmy Carter.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then, of course, with the October surprise, we heard Barbara Honegger on this program yesterday, the Bush administration conspiring with the Iranians to hold the hostages so that Jimmy Carter lost that election. He was way ahead right up until the last month or so, and that was entirely the result of the Iranian hostages, our hostages, being held in Iran at the behest of Bush and Reagan. That Reagan's first official act of office was to roll back Jimmy Carter's programs and remove the solar collectors from the roof of the White House. Here's Jimmy Carter finishing up his speech here on his solar goals.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, you realize if 20% of our energy in the year 2000 was coming from solar power, we wouldn't have had to buy a drop of oil from Saudi Arabia. Not one drop. And Osama bin Laden very clearly said back in the mid-1990s that the two problems he had with us, the two reasons why he was going to attack us, were one, that we had American infidels on holy Saudi soil, men who were drinking alcohol and women who were driving cars and who were not veiled. And, of course, this is because George Bush put them there, George Bush the Elder, in 1991 for the Gulf War. And Osama wanted them removed from Saudi property. George Bush Jr. did that about 6 months ago, by the way, with very little fanfare, pulled our troops out of Saudi Arabia. And number two, that Osama bin Laden felt that with oil at $18 a barrel, which is what we were paying when George W. Bush came into office in 2001, with oil at $18 a barrel, that we were ripping off Saudi Arabia of their natural resources, that their oil was worth more than $18 a barrel, and that a corrupt administration colluding with a corrupt Bush administration in the United States was ripping off his country. He felt the price of oil should be between $100 and $200 a barrel. And I'm predicting it will be within a year, by the way. But had this been done right, had we simply followed Jimmy Carter's prescription, there never would have been a 9/11. I lay this whole thing right at the feet of George W. Bush. I just have to say. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Dolores in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. Dolores?
Yeah, Monongahela.
Thank you. You can say it better than I can.
Oh, hey, Tom. I listen to you every day, and I learn so much from your program. But what I'll try to get to the point, I read Haas Assad, Haas Bush, An American Dynasty with Its Lies and Deceits about Bushes.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary book.
Well, what I wanted to ask you, does anybody ever, according to the book, it said that the Bushes are big investors, like defense, energy, everything.
Right.
And that the Middle East is a money spigot for the Bushes.
Yeah.
I wonder, does anybody ever look to see how much money they have invested in these other in the Middle East?
The closest we can get to it is the other way around, actually, Dolores, and that is that from fairly reliable sources, it seems that about $1 billion over the last 30 years has been transferred from Saudi families, Saudi interests, the bin Laden family, the House of Saud. I believe Kevin Phillips noted this in his book,
right,
but I may be wrong, to the Bush family and investment groups affiliated with them, most notably the Carlyle Group, which has moved most of its investments now into defense because war has become so profitable for the Bush family,
right,
so in the Bush administration. But yeah, that's a deep one, and I have to tell you, you know, I have a cursory understanding of it, enough to know how horrific it is. But one of these days, we'll get one of these folks on who's a real expert, has written, for example, the book House of Saud, House of Bush, and talk about it in more detail. Dolores, thank you for the call. It's nice to hear
from
you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Nick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay. Tom, you know what? I appreciate that you're bringing up this fact that it seems like the Bushes and this cabal here are trying to, like, actually destroy the United States. I'd like to tie into that also the comment that you're making here now, is that it really does seem to be that there's a lot of people that are living a lot better of a standard of living. Their lives, it's a higher standard of living, and that they're being more resourceful and just more ingenuity involved in intelligence. But at the same time, because of our media, you know, we're not even getting anything as to, you know, what these conditions are like. And all we're really getting is that there's no place better than the United States. But I think maybe it's time that we start to hearken to the fact that it might not be the case. Like everything else here, you know, it kind of seems to be like a falsehood too here, that and we're being cheated.
We're 29th in the world in terms of the quality of health care. We're 8th in the world in terms of life expectancy. We're 49th in the world in terms of education. I mean, no, if you want a country that has a higher standard of living than the United States, you know, there's a half a dozen Scandinavian countries to begin with. Absolutely. The other thing is that people say, I had a conservative on the other day. He says, oh, you know, look at any highway during Russia. Look at all these new cars. Look at all these homes that are being built. And I say, yes, and all those people are mortgaged up to their eyeballs. The smallest economic hiccup, and we're back to the Great Depression. We are absolutely living on the edge. We're living way beyond our means. And Bush has thrown this country essentially into bankruptcy. Nick, I appreciate the call. Thank you for bringing that up, raising that point. Billy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Billy, listening on KRXA, is it not? KXRA.
That's right. The RX meaning the prescription A for action.
There you
in
go.
America.
KRXA. Yes, indeed.
That's right.
One of our newest affiliates. What's up?
Well, Tom, you know, so much is up and so much is down. Let's start with the energy policy. We do have one. It's basically we get, we make rich the dirty energy producers at the public expense.
Absolutely. And we've been doing it for a long, long time. Ever since Jimmy Carter got his election robbed from him by Reagan and Bush.
Speaking of public expense, I'd like to ask you to do us all a favor. And that is Bernie Sanders is your buddy, right?
To the extent that anybody is Bernie's buddy. I know him.
But. Okay. What I think we need to do is ask the most independent man in government today, basically to help us fight government, because Congress people, you know, the legislators are such pigs, you know, like that bill we just got, the highway bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's just pork.
Well,
I would love.
Hang on just a second, Billy. To a certain extent, you're buying into a stereotype of the media. I mean, the reality is that we do have an infrastructure in the United States that is crumbling and has been ignored, number one. And so a lot of that is needed. And
sure.
Secondly, the other thing, though, this is really important, Billy. The other thing is that the highway bill, even the pork parts of it, and I'm not defending them, but I think that we need to acknowledge this, even the pork parts of it are better than the things that are in the defense bill. And here's why. If you build any sort of infrastructure in the United States, even marginally useful infrastructure, even a bridge that goes to an island with only 5,000 people on it, that money, first of all, is going to generate local jobs. It's going to go into the local economy. It's going to be recycled locally. It's going to, you know, that sort of thing, number one. And number two, you've got a physical asset that has a useful life of 20 or 30 years that's going to continue producing money. On the other hand, if you put that same money into building a bomb that's going to be dropped on an Iraqi city, that there's going to be a short-term profit for that defense contractor and for the Carlyle group that owns them, and then once that bomb is dropped, that money is gone forever.
Well, actually, I agree with you, don't forget, after we drop the bomb, we have Halliburton come in to clean up so we continue to make money.
Yeah, well, they continue to make money. Actually, they are a company listed in the Caymans, so it's not quite
we. Exactly. Here's what I have in mind, though. What I want to see is a law passed that says for 20 years after a legislator votes, gets some pork into a bill, it can't be named for him. This Don Young Bridge
is so
disgusting to me
that
I want to slap the guy silly if I ever meet him.
I understand.
It's obscene.
I understand, Billy.
One last thing.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah.
We had an article recently in the paper here about a woman, a black woman, I might add, who is standing up to them because she's the one that sort of does the auditing, and she's discovered how much they've been stealing from us. And again, where is big media covering this? You know, I saw it in my newspaper, but I don't see it on any of the TV stations. The real story that we need told, and you try to tell it often, and that is that there are profiteers in war. I want to know who they are and how they're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, and who they are and how they're doing it is Halliburton and Bechtel and all these other companies that are affiliated with the Bush administration, and the list goes on and on and on. And that's not to say that either of those companies are doing anything illegal, and that's the tragedy of it. And thank you for the call, Billy, and thanks for listening there in KRXA. That's the tragedy of it, is that the Bush administration is allowing this kind of profiteering. It's just wrong. It's just wrong. Bennett, Newburgh, New York on the line. Hey, Bennett, what's up?
Hey, hi. And, you know, listen, you've been starting each segment with a folk song, a protest folk song, and that kind of triggered a thought in my head about what's going on today with the artists who are supposed to be helping wake people up. You used that phrase earlier. And, I just am scared stiff that it's not going on. My kids are now in their early teens, and they're starting to play at open mic nights all over upstate New York and New England. And I go to these open mic events where I'm expecting to hear at least one out of every 10 songs be political. Tom, it's terrifying. Almost zero. It's just it's scary as hell.
The cons have created an environment, Bennett, where people are terrified. Nobody wants to be the Dixie Chicks. They don't want to be vilified for simply speaking out in the context of art. Traditionally, art was protest. I mean, the old nursery rhymes were protests against the kings.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
They were.
Which
they actually were.
Well, for example,
the story of Humpty Dumpty was making fun of a king who had started a war that he couldn't win. I'm telling you the truth. Yeah, if you go back to the what's her name who sat down, you know, with the spider, all of those were ways when it was illegal
Little
to diss
Miss
the
Muffet.
King. Yeah, Little Miss Muffet.
Was,
all
that
of
was
those.
A sit-in?
All
that was,
of those.
That was a,
All of those.
I didn't know. Wow, I have to. Where'd you learn this? It's fascinating.
I don't know where I learned it. I've known it for years. This was all subversive stuff back in the days when it was illegal to say subversive things. So they did it in metaphor. They would tell stories and make fun of the local royal family or make fun of the king. And that's how many of these stories came about, is that they're actually political in content. But these cons today, Bennett, have succeeded in creating such a climate of fear on the part of people that's why you're not hearing them speak up. And the more of us who do speak up, the more fearlessness there will be out there. So, Bennett, I salute you for doing the good work and spreading the good word, and thank you for calling to the program as well. And we need to be out there speaking up so that more fearless people, particularly young people, will stand up and participate in this great democracy. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a-shaking on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing syndicated, spinning liberal people beater.
Right-wing, strung-out, hypocrite, prescription cheater. Rush looks strange to me.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. No, we're not eating Oxycontin here. We'll leave that to Rush. Armin's on the line from Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
Quickly about money, I want to make a point. You said that the bombs, once they're gone, that's it. That's the end of the money. No, money doesn't work that way. Money is always there somewhere. The question about money is always, does it circulate or does it not circulate?
You're right. I was speaking about value, not money.
Right. Anyway, I'd like to say something else, too. The other night, Monday night, here in Bradenton, Florida, on the educational channel, they had a real nice gentleman. I believe he's a retired colonel, and he's the point man for Jeb Bush on illegal drugs. And he had a speech at the Lakewood Ranch Community Center for the Rotary Club, and I listened to the whole thing. It was very interesting. He's very articulate. He's very educated, and looks to be a very honorable man. And he was talking about all the problems and what they're containing and the shipments and this and that and all this and putting out all the facts and the bottom lines and stuff. And he says, what's sliding under the radar in this country is prescription drug abuse. And he says, it's looking real bad. You know, the acceleration curve, the trend, you know.
Especially with young people.
Right. And then my thing is, whose father is on the board of a large pharmaceutical?
Well, you know, Donald Rumsfeld used to be the chairman of what was it, Searle, I think, pharmaceuticals.
Right, whose brother signed the illegal Medicare prescription bill, and whose family's blind trust is invested in pharmaceutical stocks? And the problem, he said, obviously it's encroaching, you know, on Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah.
So see how they create wealth?
Here we are dealing with what looks like organized crime increasingly, tragically, in the United States. War profiteering, cronyism.
And in the Mideast time, Reagan and Bush set the Mideast up, and Bush and PNAC want to take it down.
There you go. Yeah, well said, Armin. Thanks for the call. Always nice to hear from you, and I appreciate your listening.
Thank you, sir.
Good to hear from you. What can we do about it? What we can do, my friends, is we can get politically active. Go to Democracy for America and sign up. Go to Democrats.org, Democrats.com, two different sites, two different, you know, Democrats.org, the Democratic Party, Democrats.com, a great site, Bob Furtick runs it. Start reading the news, Buzz Flash, Common Dreams, Op-Ed News, TV Truth and Lies. Start educating yourself and educating others. Tag, you're it. Pass it along.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes, 7 minutes after the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. Our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Here we are moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Talk radio for the rest of us. Larry in Aptos, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Lance Armstrong's on my mind. It seems like the major corporate media, unlike last year and the year before that and the year before that and the year before that, remember it would have been Lance Armstrong 24/7.
Right.
Well, he makes a couple of statements about the Iraq war and George Bush, and suddenly he's off the radar screen, isn't he?
Yeah, I thought that was rather interesting. Here's the crowning achievement of his career, and it was a huge, as you point out, the last 2 years, it was just a huge big deal, and he is the all-American hero. He's the guy who overcame, you know, a terrible cancer that had spread to his brain, and he just an enormous achievement. And as soon as he speaks out against George Bush, boom, he's not even invited on the sports shows.
Well, I don't know how much the major media may have even covered the fact that he made those statements, but I guess it was a few weeks ago. I heard that on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman's program.
Yeah, it did get covered, and that was the end of it. That was the end of Lance's public visibility.
Yeah, and I remember at that time I thought, that's it. He's going to get cut off.
Yeah, and he did. He did. As soon as he spoke out against the war in Iraq, or what they call the war, I would call the occupation of Iraq. It's not really a war. I mean, we had an invasion, and that was successful militarily. It was a stupid thing to do, but it was a militarily successful. And now we have an occupation which has been totally bungled right from the very beginning, and which we are losing. We are failing. And I, as I said, I've predicted many times, George Bush, before the November elections of next year, will declare victory and pull out, or pull back to the military bases, and carefully control the news cycle. Larry, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there on KRXA. 1-866-889-8894. Will in Pittsburgh. WPTT. Hey, Will, what's on your mind?
Tom, I think the world of you. Yeah, you have a hell of a show.
Well, thank you, Will.
I mean that. I was over in Germany about 5 years ago, and prior to that I had made three trips. I am surprised how they conserve energy over there.
Oh, it's amazing. I lived there for a year in the 80s, and I can tell you, conservation is a way of life. In fact, Europeans, on average, use one-seventh the energy that we use here in the United States. We are 4% of the world's population. We consume 25% of the world's energy.
Tom, you were mentioning Carter.
Yeah.
I remember when Nixon tried to do that, too. Remember?
Nixon was in favor of conservation. Well, Nixon was the one who was president when the first oil shock happened. And he was rationing, against all of his free market principles. Nixon was rationing gas and, you know, odd even days and the whole thing. It was 72, was it, or 73? I remember we were living in Detroit at the time. Louise and I, she was pregnant with our first child. And the supermarkets all went empty. The Teamsters had gone on strike and because the prices of fuel were going through the roof. And the supermarkets in Detroit all went empty. And we were, like, really concerned, you know, if this lasts very long, do we really want to be living in a big city like this? You know, what will happen? And fortunately, you know, we got around it. But it points out the fragility of the system. And Nixon got it and Carter got it. And then Reagan came along and he had completely sold out to the oil interests and the big coal interests and the big corporations. His kitchen cabinet, right? I mean, you know, Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz, the former vice president and president of Bechtel Corporation, for example, advising Reagan. So, you know, there you go. We've got the energy policy that we have. It's time for our segment. Every week I want to really focus on labor for a few minutes and even more than just a few minutes and keep us up to date, because the mainstream media does such a great job of totally locking out, freezing out any discussion of labor. Used to be newspapers had a labor section and a business section. It simply doesn't happen anymore. All the corporate-owned newspapers, they don't talk about labor anymore. We talk about labor here on this program. And one of our regular guests in that context is Alec Dubrow. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA. Their website, ilcaonline.org. And Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I hope labor's message isn't solely on my shoulders. I'm just one voice.
No, it's not.
And one with a lot of strange opinions as well.
There you go.
Okay.
We have other labor guests on as well, but you are you're right at the nexus of all this, because one of the jobs of the International Labor Communications Association is to help labor communicate its message and coordinate that message, and you're doing a great job of it. I want to salute you for that. I understand in Chicago this month, UNI is meeting, and I doubt most Americans even know what UNI is.
Well, worse than most Americans, most union members and a fair number of union leaders have no idea what UNI is.
So enlighten us.
Okay. They're meeting week after next in Chicago, their second World Congress, and UNI is one of 10 groups called Global Union Federations. UNI represents a slew of diverse unions at the international level, including a lot of American unions. Altogether, they have 15 million members from 1,000 unions.
Wow.
And they're just one of 10 groups. Other ones are even somewhat larger. And one supergroup called the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions says that through their structure, not directly each person, but they represent 120 million people. Now, we don't hear about them. The only time I ever heard a story about global union federations here was many years ago when one of their staff people got caught in some espionage ring. But other than that, I've never heard them talked about in the slightest. And here, this is a huge conference in Chicago. A number of American unions are participating in it. And it's fascinating why they chose. They tend to be European-based. They are European-based. And they held their congresses all over. But they decided to hold theirs in Chicago. And the reason was the president or the general secretary said, in the aftermath of Bush's reelection, it's even more important than ever that we go to the U.S. with a strong pro-union message.
You know what's so ironic, Alec? Pardon my interrupting you here. What I just find so amazingly ironic about this whole thing is that unions, by and large, in the early 1900s, right up through the Great Depression and World War II, were a growing force in the United States. There was a growing union movement in Europe, but they really weren't a major political force in Europe. In fact, they were viewed with a jaundiced eye by many because many thought that they were part of the communist conspiracy, the Bolshevik Revolution had happened, all that kind of stuff. And it was World War II. After World War II, those nasty liberals, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, well, Harry Truman, really, and Dwight Eisenhower and whatnot, helped draft the Constitution for Germany and helped put back together France and the other countries that the Germans had occupied. And in drafting the German Constitution, did for the Germans what they wanted to do for Americans. I mean, you know, Harry Truman in 1947 tried to pass national health insurance for all Americans. He couldn't do it, so he wrote it into the German Constitution. In 1935, they passed the Wagner Act, ensuring every American the right to unionize. In 1947, the election of 46, the Republicans took the House and the Senate federally, and Harry Truman tried to stop them. He vetoed the Taft-Hartley Act, but they passed it over his veto, and so individual states could opt out in many ways from the Wagner Act. So he was being defeated. Unions were being, you know, harmed, our ability to unionize here in the United States. So he wrote it into the Constitution of Germany that they would have the right to strong unions. And so all over Europe, as a result of the liberal Democrats of the United States, this incredibly high standard of living has been achieved by European countries. And because of strong labor, because we helped them do it. And now two things are happening. One is they're under assault because their governments are going more right wing all the time. You've got the right wingers about to take over in Germany. You got Tony Blair with his new labor in England, which is, you know, thinly disguised Thatcherism in some ways. There's this anti-labor agenda spreading, coming out of these big corporations and money and politics. And they're having to come to the United States to tell us, hey, here's how you do it. You know, here's how you have unions. Here's how you have successful unions. I just find it amazing. Pardon my interrupting your thing, but I just
want to get that out. No. I think it's really great to draw these links between the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Right, and we did this for Japan, by the way, too. We also wrote unions into their constitution, and they have strong labor protections. Whereas in Iraq, the conservatives rewrote the constitution for Iraq, Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and Cheney and Bush. We rewrote that constitution, and we made unions illegal. And look what it's done. We now have, you know, 50% unemployment in Iraq, and so what do? They pick up guns and shoot them, and, you know, point them at us. I mean, I'm ranting. Your turn, Alec.
I'll rant later. But in Japan, it's very interesting. You call these people conservatives. Douglas MacArthur was as close to an emperor as Japan was going to get in that period. Douglas MacArthur was a staunch conservative who had battled the bonus marchers and unions in the United States. When he got to Japan and took it over, he said it was his moral obligation. If workers elsewhere had the rights to unions, they should have it in Japan. Too bad that it went against his own grain.
Yeah. And went against the emperor's grain, by the way, as well.
That's
true. I mean,
it
flew in the face of Japanese tradition. Japanese tradition was basically feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L.
That's right. So. Exactly true. But it's interesting. The United States often pushes to try its economic and social experiments on other countries to see how how it might work. And one of the first examples was in Chile in 73 after the coup, when they pushed for and got as unregulated an economy as you could get. And I bring that up because it's very interesting, because right now Chileans are experiencing the first generation to reach retirement age in a privatized social security system. And from all the communications we get from labor in Chile, this is disastrous for a wide swath of the country.
Yeah. And this is what the cons want to bring us here. Alec, we have about a minute left to wrap this up. You wanted to talk about uni? No.
I'll wrap it up.
Okay.
The parallel group for the public sector unions, PSI, has wanted to bring these Chileans to the United States in order to testify before Congress and talk to the media about what will happen if you continue on a privatization path of Social Security. So far, they haven't had the means to do it, and people ask in this country, why should we support international labor groups? Well, this is why. Because our economy is integrated. If labor isn't integrated, we don't have a force that can counteract that. That's why we do it.
That's right. It's all about power. And labor is the check and balance in the economy, just like, you know, the Republicans and Democrats or the House and the Senate or the judiciary, the executive and legislative branches are the checks and balance in government in capitalism. The check and balance for capitalism and free enterprise is organized labor.
If you don't have a left wing, you fly around in circles. That's the way it works.
Well said. Alec Dubrow with the International Labor Communications Association. The website is ilcaonline.org. ILCA as in International Labor Communications Association. Alec, you're doing great work there. Continue it. Keep it up.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Always
Take
great
care.
Talking to you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, in times of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes an act, a revolutionary act. As George Orwell said, so true. Welcome back to the program, Truth in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman Program, 25 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room and say hello, just click live chat. Ellen Ratner is with us, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the White House just released about an hour ago, not even that, probably a half hour ago, a letter that they sent from Ed Gillespie, who is managing, former RNC chair, who is managing the Roberts agenda.
And before that, by the way, he was a $700,000 a year lobbyist for Enron.
Well, he was a lobbyist for anybody who needed a lobbyist,
right,
on either side of the fence, I may add.
Yeah.
And basically, what happened is Senator Wyden met yesterday with Roberts at the, you know, at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, he talked to the New York Times and said some things. And apparently, the New York Times, according to the White House, decided not to contact the White House for comment. And apparently, the staff people who attended this meeting with Judge Roberts, he said that he, Fred Thompson, Senator, former Fred Thompson, said he doesn't believe that the discussion was made as they said it was made. And so now the White House is saying, had the New York Times bothered to call the White House, they would have had a very different view of it.
Oh, that's
than
very
Senator
interesting.
Wyden did.
Now this is plain. Now, let's just, for our listeners who don't know the details of this, it sounds a little inside baseball. Ron Wyden is the Democratic senator from Oregon, and Oregon is the only state that has physician-assisted suicide laws that allow people to terminate their own lives under certain circumstances. And
very rarely used, may I add.
And in fact, one of the things that we've discovered here in Oregon is that when people get the drugs that they can use to end their own lives, they're then less likely to commit suicide than people in states who don't have access to those drugs, interestingly, because they feel like they have control over the end of their lives. They,
right,
don't, they end up not using them. That's a whole other discussion. But anyhow, so Ron Wyden got big press in the Oregonian, in the newspapers here in Oregon today, about how he had assurances from Judge Roberts that Judge Roberts would not interfere with end-of-life decisions like the Terry Schiavo case, that he thought that that was inappropriate. And you're saying now that the White House is saying, oh, no, Roberts didn't say that?
That's what the White House is saying. And they say that Roberts' courtesy visits with senators are closed to the press and are treated as private by Roberts and the White House. But if a senator chooses to publicly characterize the nature of those conversations, the White House would appreciate the opportunity to provide a fuller accounting of a two-way discussion. And they said the New York Times is welcome to contact our press office for such perspective 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, this was released to all the White House press today.
Wow. Well, it seems, you know, I mean, I read the story in the Oregonian this morning. It seemed like it was good. Like, you know, if Ron Wyden was saying this guy, and Ron Wyden's a Democrat, and he's a fairly decent Democrat here in Oregon, that if Ron Wyden was saying that he thought that Roberts was probably not that bad a guy, that it would take, you know, a little wind out of the sails of the anti-Roberts forces here in Oregon. Why is the White House concerned about this?
Well, but you would think that, you see, but the White House also has to contend with the fact that their right wing is very unhappy,
and
in fact, Family Research Council and some of these whack birds are having a meeting on Sunday at one of the Baptist churches.
Whack birds, I love it. Okay.
In fact, there was a guy on the courthouse steps today that we are just getting some sound. We'll get it to you a little later. Who is now denouncing Roberts from the right because of his pro-homosexual agenda?
Yeah, because he dared to defend a gay group. Yeah.
Right. The White House has got to ride herd on the whackbirds on their right side so they don't scuttle the nomination.
It's a done deal. I don't think either side's going to do it.
I agree.
But they're also trying to keep their powder dry for the next time around, or whatever the appropriate metaphor is.
You got it.
Not burn their bridges. Thanks a lot, Ellen. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.
It. Good to hear from you. Ellen Ratner in Washington, D.C. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for listening. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, TomHartmann.com, the website. Michelle in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI, one of our very first affiliates, one of my favorite stations. Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi, what's up?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that when I found you in the middle of the radio station one day, it was a breath of fresh air and really helpful because the media was never giving me perspective. Even on the Internet, what you've done is add that historical perspective, you know, of Jefferson and Madison and what you keep saying. So I've been listening for a few months now, and I'm really, it's really helped me.
Well, thank you.
One of my problems is I live in, not a problem, I love that I live in Illinois. We've got Durbin, and I've been a little disappointed with Obama, but he's there. And even my senator, or not my senator, my representative from Southern Illinois is Democratic. So how do I help in the 2006 elections? How do I help? Yeah.
Yeah, show up. Have you contacted your local Democratic Party?
Well, we have a pretty good Green Party here that I was thinking of doing, but right, I need to go into Democratic.
I would do both, Michelle. You know, I encourage people to participate in the Green Party. The Green Party is doing some really, really wonderful work on the ground in the local areas around the United States. We have over 200, I think maybe even over 300 communities now in the United States that have instant runoff voting as a result of Green Party participation. The Green Party is leading the charge for clean elections. They're doing great stuff, and I encourage people to participate with the Green Party. At the same time, there's no rule that says you can't also show up at the Democratic Party meetings and, you know, and vote when the vote comes for, you know, whichever candidate you think is going to do the best job and isn't going to end up splitting the ticket. That's, of course, the big concern. But I think that both of these parties are worthy of our support. And I think it's unfortunate that people think that they have to make a choice between the two, because what we really need are Greens infiltrating the Democratic Party and taking it over from within and participating in the apparatus. And in most communities, the Democratic Party apparatus has atrophied. You know, it's become kind of moribund. It's old and stagnant. And if you show up and start and bring a half a dozen friends, you may end up being able to get yourself elected as chairman of the local party. I mean, it's actually happened to a couple of our listeners.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, do you go out there? But I appreciate it. But part of it is that, you know, with Durbin, and even here in this state, there were so many people that were so stupid with Durbin and not supportive of him. And then, you know, Obama has really gotten a lot of funding. And I'm curious because I know Gene seems to have lost some faith in him. And it seems like he is going to help in other states and other congressional districts. But how... I'd like to get more information about where Obama's really letting us down.
Well, why don't you call his office and talk with him? You know, have a conversation with him. It's toll-free, 1-877-SOB-USOB is the phone number for Congress, and just ask for Barack Obama's office, and they'll put you through. Tell him you're a constituent. Give him your name and address, and say, I'd like to have a conversation with somebody about some of these issues. And my guess is they'll be pretty stand up with you. They'll be pretty straightforward.
Okay, thank you.
And then regularly let them know what you think. The other great group that's doing really good grassroots stuff, Michelle, is Democracy for America, the group that Howard Dean started that his brother Jim Dean is running now. And their website, I'm pretty sure, is democracyforamerica.com. And if not, you can easily Google it, but I'm pretty sure that's it. And they are starting local groups all over the United States, and they're doing some really marvelous stuff. And they have meetups where once a month you get together. And I've been to several of them, both in Vermont when I lived there and now in Oregon living here. And it's a nonpartisan group. I mean, they tend to like the Democratic Party, but they're really not about partisan politics. They're about dealing with issues, issue-based politics, a progressive agenda, and advancing that and helping get people elected who will advance that agenda, almost regardless of what their party is. Although, you know, it seems that mostly these are Democratic candidates who are out there who have the potential to actually win an election. But Democracy for America is a great group. Michelle, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening on WINI there. I do appreciate it. Coach Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Tom, in talking about unions and Iraqi freedom, I know you've said in the past that we prohibited their forming unions.
Well, actually, it was Osama bin Laden who prohibited the formation of unions in the public sector, which constitutes about, arguably, depending on whose numbers you're using, somewhere between 50 and 70% of the total economy of Iraq. And in fact, you know, before we invaded, perhaps as much as 90% of the total economy of Iraq was public sector. And Saddam Hussein did not allow unions in the public sector. We continued that. We maintained that. So that's the reality.
Okay, well, if they have freedom, why not write it into their new constitution? How can they, what are we going to say? You can't do that?
Well, they may. I mean, you know, they're writing a constitution right now, and I can tell you that the cons in Washington, D.C. are not very happy with a lot of the things that are being written into this constitution. But, of course, it wasn't George Bush's idea that there be elections in Iraq. He wanted there to be the caucuses, like they have in Iowa, you know, where you get a bunch of people together in a room and they vote and they're handpicked. But in this case, he wanted it to be handpicked people. And it was the Shia, specifically Sadr and Sistani, who took hundreds of thousands of people to the streets and demanded elections over the objections of George W. Bush. And then the elections were held, and Bush, of course, took credit for them. But those elections, I suspect, are going to bite him in the butt. And in fact, in the next hour, we're going to have Larry Johnson on from the CIA, formerly the CIA, one of the founders of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, former CIA operative. And I wanted to get him on because I wanted to talk with him about a brilliant piece he wrote about what's going on in Iran and Iraq and between Iran and Iraq, and how are we being played for suckers, and, you know, how is the Bush administration playing into the hands of these folks, and what could happen if the situation blows up, and where is it going to go? It's a very complicated situation in some ways, and in some ways it's so startlingly simple. And Larry Johnson's going to come on at the top of the next hour and help inform us on all that. So I'll defer the conversation at that point. Glenn,
great.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Along those same lines, I just, you know, speaking of during times of universal deceit, truth-telling becomes a revolutionary act, as George Orwell said. I think it's so important that we remember some of the truth-tellers in our society. You will recall that after the 2000 election, remember the 2000 election? After the 2000 election, when Catherine Harris had removed some 80,000 African-American voters from the voting polls in Florida before the election to steal the election on behalf of George W. Bush, and that lawsuit is still ongoing, the ACLU, but there is no doubt about this fact, that she and Jeb Bush criminally conspired to throw these people off the voting rolls, people who were not convicted felons, people who simply had, their crime was voting while black. That Catherine Harris did this, and this is why the Republican Party doesn't want her to run for the Senate, because, you know, it's an embarrassment to them. They don't like this being raised, this whole issue. But anyhow, even that wasn't enough. And so George W. Bush sued Al Gore to stop the vote from being counted. And that was Bush v. Gore. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and five members of the Supreme Court voted to stop the count. Four voted that they wanted the count to continue. And the swing vote, of course, was Sandra Day O'Connor. She gave the presidency to George W. Bush. And they said, this is only for this one case. And so all this newspaper consortium said, well, let's actually count the ballots. And almost 2 years later, in the November 13th, as I recall, it was November 12th or 13th of 2002. If you go back in the archives of the New York Times, it'll cost you $2.50 to buy the article. It's there in the New York Times or the Washington Post. They actually did the count, and they found that if every county in Florida had been counted, that Al Gore would have won the state of Florida. In other words, if there had been the recount, if every vote had been counted, Al Gore won the state of Florida. No matter pregnant chads, hanging chads, dimpled chads, intent of voter, or not intent of voter, it doesn't matter. As they said in the New York Times, by any measure, Al Gore won the state of Florida. So I think it's important that occasionally we listen to the man who actually should be the president of the United States, who actually won the election in 2000, both several million by a majority of several million in the popular vote and in the state of Florida, Al Gore. And his thoughts on George W. Bush are virtually prescient. I mean, this is a rant from before the campaign of 2004. But it is becoming so obvious that there was some radical truth telling going on then that we need to be listening to again. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President, and many would say President of the United States, Al Gore.
Because I think there were millions just like me who genuinely, in spite of whatever partisanship they may have felt prior to that time, genuinely felt like they wanted George W. Bush to lead all of us in America wisely and well. And the reason I'm recalling those feelings now is because those are the feelings that were betrayed by this president. He betrayed this country.
He betrayed this country. He betrayed this country by playing on the fears of 9/11.
He took America. He took America on an ill-conceived foreign adventure, dangerous to our troops, an adventure that was preordained and planned before 9/11 ever took place.
And we know now that that was the case. The Project for New American Century pushing for it. A letter signed by Cheney, Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush back in 98. George Bush telling his biographer in 99 that if he got elected, he would have a war that would give him political capital. He wouldn't make the mistake of his father and pull out too early.
So whether it's the economy, where he said he'd be a moderate, or social policy, where he said he'd be middle of the road, compassionate, or foreign policy and military policy, I will say to the president that it is not a minor matter to take the loyalty and deep patriotic feelings of the American people and trifle with them for purposes that are not in the best traditions of America. And so I say to you in closing, my friends, in the year 2004, the truth shall rise again.
Well, and it may well be that the truth did rise again in the year 2004. The exit polls, after all, point out that John Kerry won by 3 million votes. So go figure. Go figure. And John Conyers, his investigations in Ohio, a massive vote theft involving at least several hundred thousand votes. And, of course, if 80,000 people in the state of Ohio had voted for Kerry instead of Bush, Kerry would be president right now. So, you know, who can say? Anyhow, you know, even without conspiracy theories, who can say? We can't say because we have private for-profit corporations counting our votes and telling us how we voted. And nobody, Republican, Democrat, Green, left, right, middle, nobody can tell you or I that our vote actually did get counted because a private for-profit corporation answerable to its stockholders and not to we the people took our vote and counted it in a way that is invisible, using software that they will not allow us to see, because it's a trade secret. That, my friends, is a felony against democracy, pure and simple. But I digress. It's a bit of a off-topic rant. Anyhow, Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, just real quick, just want to comment on the situation, the disaster in Florida. It really wasn't so much a situation of, you know, African Americans being just jettisoned from the voter rolls. It was just the fact that Democrats, in general, and then in particular citizens, can be actually just manipulated and, you know, separated.
Well, here's part of the problem, Jason, though, and that is certainly they did it this most heavily in those heavily Democratic counties. But one of the vestiges of slavery, one of the remnants, one of the leftovers of slavery, one of the tragic leftovers of slavery in the United States, is that many African Americans share common names, the names of the slaveholders of their time. And so if you take the variety of names among Caucasians and the variety of names among African Americans, it's smaller among African Americans, that variety. And so when Catherine Harris had this company in Texas, Choice Point, had this company in Texas take a list of Texas felons and merge it and purge it against a list of Democratic county voters in Florida, the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of African Americans in Florida who had very similar names to felon African Americans in Texas and got purged because of that remnant of racism and slavery in the United States.
Right, and that's not to say that it's any less insidious, because it's still that throwback racist Jim Crowism, you know, from way back.
I'd say it's even more insidious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but, the other point is I heard Rick Santorum on this morning on one of the morning talk shows, Diane Rehm, if I can mention her.
That's fine.
A very, very good program. But he was on and just kind of explaining away his book that kind of copped the name from Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village, and he just kind of put a new twist on it.
But
I guess the emphasis is a bit twisted. If anybody heard him speak this morning, he's, you know, ranting about, you know, a lot of things. But in particular, he was trying to explain the difference between conservatives and liberals. And every time I hear conservatives speak about their differences, it always breaks down to sex. It's like they have some kind of perverse obsession about sex. And, you know, and I know where it's coming from. You know, if they can stick the sex moniker on someone, then they've already got them, you know, dead in the water as far as, like, public perception.
Yeah, I think they were toilet trained too early or something. It's you know, who knows?
I mean, I don't know what this fixation is on sex, but the conservatives have a just kind of phobic obsession over other people.
Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to us on WTKG there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour. You're in the real free speech zone.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Propaganda, propaganda. Try and convince the folks that beach is never sandy. You can convert into lies what they've seen with their own eyes. It's amazing. Propaganda.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Dave, listening on KGOE in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. For a long time, as you know, I have become convinced that the key to this devastation that we're facing is in these voting machines. And I keep thinking there's got to be a way that they can be made honest or kicked out. A wonderful thing happened here in California. You know, the new Secretary of State also ruled, as Kevin Shelley had, that they were just undependable and untrustworthy and could not be used in this state.
I know.
State.
It surprised me. It surprised
a lot of us, you know, yeah. Because that was an appointment from the new governor who hasn't done much right. But yeah. It is possible. Where there is something happening that's a threat, that you can go into a federal court and request an injunction or a stop order, a cease and desist, and just make the case, and attorneys surely can do it, that these machines pose too much of a threat, a risk to the democracy in this country.
That's what Paul Leto is doing. He's been on this program a couple of times. He's an attorney in Washington State, and he's suing Snohomish County, Washington, which is where he lives, over the voting machines, saying that because you can't observe the counting of the vote, it is a violation of the Voting Rights Act and other laws. And of course, this might be one of the reasons why the Republicans are talking about not renewing the Voting Rights Act. But in any case, he says because you can't observe this, it's illegal. And so, and he's got a strong case. And if he wins that, a lot's going to happen. So we'll keep on that. And I'm going to get Paul back on the program again. Dave, I appreciate the call. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's ironic you brought up Vice President Gore. He's been on my mind. I have a solid novel idea, if I may.
You got 30 seconds here.
I know. I believe Al Gore should be the next president of the United States.
I don't disagree with you. I think he's a good man.
And why? Because exactly how we described it. He deserves another shot. I think he has the domestic foreign policy experience needed. He's savvy. And maybe best of all, I think he's willing to take both gloves off now.
Yeah, although, you know, he's now into a business venture. I think he's kind of left politics behind him, but time will tell. You know, he went up against the Bush machine, and he got slimed. He got slimed badly. I mean, they lied about him. They stole an election from him.
That's all the more the reason why he deserves to be the next president of the United States.
You know, I don't disagree with you at all, Gary. And wouldn't it be wonderful? Because he would make a great president. I doubt it's going to happen, but it would be wonderful. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Gary. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here on the banks of the Willamette River in Portland, Oregon. Day by day, exposing the con in conservative.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry C. Johnson is the CEO and founder of Berg Associates, LLC, an international business consulting firm that helps multinational corporations and financial institutions identify strategic opportunities, manage risks, and counter threats posed by terrorism and money laundering. He's uniquely qualified to do this from 1989 until October of 93. Larry Johnson served as a deputy director in the U.S. State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He managed crisis response operations for terrorist incidents throughout the world, and he helped organize and direct the U.S. government's debriefing of U.S. citizens held in Kuwait and Iraq, which provided vital intelligence on Iraqi operations following the 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Mr. Johnson also participated in the investigation of the terrorist bombings of Pan Am 103, and his leadership under his leadership, the U.S. airlines and pilots agreed to match the U.S. government's $2 million reward. So, Mr. Johnson, you also worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, as I recall.
And basically, I can't hold a job.
I love it.
You know, I say, hey, I has been.
Here we are. We're easily distracted guys.
It's, yeah.
So you've been on the inside, right? ADD all the way. You've been on the inside of all of this stuff, and you wrote this piece with Patrick Lang, W. Patrick Lang, Another View of Shia Iran. And the reason I wanted to call you and talk with you about this on the air is because yesterday I had Barbara Honegger on the program, and she was talking about how the Reagan administration, the Reagan campaign, which she had been a part of, had negotiated with the Iranians to hold the hostages in order to cause Carter to lose the election. And she pointed out that the guy who was in charge one of the people who was participated in that is now one of the people who's participating in leading the kind of the point man for Judge Roberts, you know, that these folks are still around. And that it involved the Iranians, and she said that the Iranians were involved in some way in 9/11 and destabilizing the Middle East and whatnot, and you know, at that point I'm like, I don't know where I'm crossing the boundary from, you know, gee, this makes sense, to another conspiracy theory, and which is not to say that conspiracy theories aren't true. I mean, there's a lot of conspiracies out there,
right?
But the article that you wrote, you raise these issues about what's up with Iran, and I think that this is really kind of transpartisan. This isn't about Republican or Democrat. This is about what are the interests of the United States and what's happening in the world. And I just want to shed some light on this. So let's just go back a little bit and start out with when George Bush came into office in 2001, we had Iran basically in a box. They had agreed to suspend their nuclear program, just as North Korea had. They had been historically constrained by the presence of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They had fought an 8-year war between the two of them. Neither one of them won. They fought it to a draw, lost 1 million young men in that war between the two of them. And so Iran's...
Actually, on that last point, Pat Lang takes some issue with that, because That had been sort of my impression, but he said it was very clear, and he was the head of Defense Intelligence Agency at the time, that in fact Iraq won the war. They forced Iran into a settlement, and remember that the reason Iraq was able to do that vis-a-vis Iran was because we were directly supporting Iraqi with intelligence and some other things.
Right, we were supporting Saddam Hussein. Well, even more to the point then, if Saddam Hussein was the primary bulwark that we had on behalf of us in the Middle East,
right,
to prevent the Iranians from exercising their theocratic ambitions in the region. And, you know, I mean, we talk about Osama bin Laden and his theocratic ambitions and the Wahhabists and all that sort of thing. They may be able to influence countries. They don't run a country. In Iran, you've actually got a country that's run by theocrats.
Right.
And so we had Saddam Hussein restraining Iran. Iran was essentially in a box. Their nuclear program had been suspended. And in their wildest dreams, what would they have wanted?
To see the United States destroy Iraq, leave the Shias in power, and put them in a position where they can get access to the bulk of the oil in the Middle East.
And we've done that now, have we not?
It's breathtaking if you step back and look at it. And you know, if we can disengage, as you properly note, from all the partisan politics of this and just look at it from a simple strategic interest. Iran right today, their people are rubbing their eyes, and when I say their people, the leadership, they're rubbing their eyes because they cannot believe we've been this pliable, this stupid. They're convinced that we've got something else up our sleeve that we're just not, we haven't sprung on them yet. But the fact of the matter is, this policy was not thought through when we went into Iraq. The Bush neocons believed their own rhetoric, and they ignored history.
In other words, we're playing checkers, and they're playing chess.
Yeah, they're
looking out five moves ahead, and we're looking at the next move.
Exactly. In fact, it's more like checkers for us.
Yeah, that's. Oh, I'm sorry if I didn't say that. That's what I meant. Yeah, they're playing chess, and we're playing checkers.
And they believe though. They look at us and they think that we're playing chess, that we ourselves are playing chess, that we're thinking two or three moves ahead just as they are. And the reality is we're not, but they assume that we are. And so because they assume that they are, they also step up some of their behind-the-scene machinations.
Right. That's why they want to restart their nuclear program and all, you know, all these other sorts of things, because they suspect that we're actually, we're speaking here of the Bush administration, that we're actually smarter than apparently we are.
Right. And they've also, you know, they understand where their interest lies. If they don't move proactively to protect themselves, they know that they cannot trust us to protect them. They know that they're on their own, and they're not going to hitch their security to any other country either. So
yeah, and the old Soviet axis is gone, and they have tentative agreements. Actually, not even tentative agreements. They have agreements with China, but China has not yet crossed that threshold where it can stare the United States down, or where it's willing to. I think that they probably could if they wanted to, but where they're willing to overtly on the world stage assume the role that the Soviet Union did for 40 years and stare us down in a mutually assured destruction kind of scenario.
Yeah, they're not there yet, but they're in a position where they're able to put us back on our heels, because, you know, right now
China is,
but in terms of working with Iran, and Iran can become in some aspects a surrogate.
Yeah, well,
so they can do things that can weaken us and allow China to stay above the fray.
Right, and Iran has become a supplier of oil and natural gas to China. China is investing in Iran very heavily right now. They're developing strategic alliances. This does not bode well for our interests in the region. Am I correct, by the way, in those statements?
Yeah. And you know, they understand where I'm coming from in this. It's I think that our best policy to pursue overseas is one that's rooted strongly in our own self-interest. If we worry about protecting ourselves and our interests, in the long run, I think we'll be better off. What we're doing right now is that we've been pursuing some fantasy, you know, the notion that we can allow democracy to spring up there without understanding you allow those people to have a majority vote, majority rule. They're going to select policies such as let's destroy Israel, let's eliminate all the Jews, let's put women back in
burkas.
Burkas. Yeah. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that, yeah, the majority can rule, but we won't like the rules that they're making.
Yeah, and in fact, we're seeing that happen in Iraq right now. They just, you know, making Shia Sharia law part of their constitution. So here's the question. You know, you point out several facts. Iran is in a stronger position to reach out to the Shia minorities in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, that they could end up essentially controlling Iraq, and probably will after the elections at the end of the year, probably covertly for the first year or so, or quietly, let's say, and then overtly as time goes on. That they control Hezbollah, which is, you know, essentially controls Lebanon, so they control Lebanon by proxy. Iran is getting stronger and stronger as a result of our misguided adventurism in the Middle East, because George W. Bush wanted to have his political capital. Cash Manhattan Project style thing, we could do it for much less than the cost of the war in Iraq, and convert the United States to a wind, solar, hydrogen economy, and say, hey, we don't need any oil in the Middle East. It's not in our interest to be there.
No, I agree with you that makes a much more sensible alternative to what we're doing. But the unfortunate fact of the matter is that right now, because our economy is so dependent upon the oil, we've got to worry about the oil. But I think, you know, if I was the president and sitting there and putting together the policy, I'd say we've got to embark on a crash program, as you properly know, like the Manhattan Project, where we really devote ourselves to coming up with alternative energy sources, so that we're not in a position of having to worry about you know, which ethnic group over in the Middle East is battling over an oil well.
Right. Now, but that's going on. Now, the reality is that in all probability, Iran is going to end up in control of Iraq, whether we like it or not. And my guess is that before the November 2006 elections here in the United States, George Bush will have drawn down our combat forces in Iraq to the point where basically they're all on the bases. Nobody's getting shot at. And things will probably have stabilized because Iran will be asserting its influence there. And Bush will be trying to convince us that there's no problem with that. Do you agree with that assessment?
Not really, because you're able to control a lot of what's going on the ground. And let's not forget that the Shias and Sunnis there hate each other. And while Iran up to this point has been playing both sides of it, and we'll say, oh, how could they do that? And we say, well, have we forgotten that, you know, in our country, we were supplying Iraq with intelligence, and then we were dealing with the Iranians at the same time.
Right.
So, you know, this idea of doing double dealing is shouldn't catch us by surprise.
So what's the scenario? We have about a minute left here, Larry Johnson. What's the scenario that you're expecting to play out over the next 2 years?
I think increased unrest in Saudi Arabia, which will put their oil fields at jeopardy, and we're going to look at much higher oil prices in this country because the oil supply is going to be more difficult for us to get access to.
And in Iraq?
Yes.
And in Iraq, do you see civil war?
Civil war is already underway. We just refuse to acknowledge it.
Yeah, well said.
It's well in place.
Yeah, yeah. And Iran's, do you think that it's possible that Iraq could split into three parts, that the Kurds will, you know, go their own way, that the Shia will align themselves with Iran, and that the Sunnis will, find some oil someplace and say, okay, that's ours?
Well, I think that's one scenario that we ought to consider pursuing. And trying to force into three different countries and then trying to deal with each of them separately.
Yeah, the Yugoslavia solution.
Yeah, that might give us some leverage and help us try to deal with this. But, you know, we've got some serious problems facing us down the road if we don't get on top of this. And this, as you properly noted, this has got to get beyond a partisan Republican, Democrat, he said, she said, because it really is going to affect the lives of all Americans. And I think...
And it is right now.
Yeah.
It is right now. Okay, Larry Johnson. Larry, is there a website you want to plug here?
The blog, No Quarter. typepad.com.
noquarter.typepad.com. People can find out more about Larry C. Johnson's thoughts. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate your perspective, your insight, and your knowledge. You're a good man. Larry Johnson. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Try me.
Yes, indeed.
Try me.
Yeah, welcome back to our program. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. You're in the Democracy Zone. Speaking of zones, the mayor of Baghdad, I mean, this is how bad things are getting, because we didn't listen to Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. I never thought I would say those words. Because we didn't listen to Richard Nixon, we're in trouble. But it's the truth. Because we didn't listen to Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter and develop a crash program to wean ourselves from dependence upon foreign oil. Here we are in this disastrous situation, being exploited by George W. Bush for political purposes and cronyism, his buddies making billions and the oil companies making out like bandits, all of that stuff. But the bottom line is that it would all of our involvement in the Middle East would be absolutely unnecessary if we weren't importing all our oil. See, back in 74 was when we hit the Hubbert peak in the United States. That's when half of our oil in our little part of North America was gone. And at that point, you know, remember Pennzoil? I mean, I'd not remember. They're still around. Pennzoil, Pennsylvania oil. It used to be Pennsylvania was covered with oil wells. New Jersey Standard Oil in New Jersey. New Jersey used to be covered with oil wells. New York used to be covered with oil wells. Ohio used to be covered with oil wells. They're all dry now. It was a big deal when they found oil in Oklahoma and Texas. Those wells are drying up. A lot of the wells in California are drying up. We passed the Hubbard Peak in 1974 in the United States. That's the point at which it starts getting very expensive to suck that last little half of the oil that's down there out. You got to suck so much harder on the straw. You finally reach the point where you get down to about, you know, three quarters of it being all gone, where it costs more to draw up. You got to spend so much energy drawing that oil up that it costs more than the oil that's there. And so at that point, you just cap the well and say, okay, that's it. We're all done. And Nixon saw this coming. M. King Hubbard predicted this back in 1955. Richard Nixon saw it coming, said, we've got to do something about it. Jimmy Carter came into office, and he put into place a program to actually do something about it. And Ronald Reagan came to power riding on the coattails of big oil, and that was the end of that. And to just show you how dangerous it has gotten now, the Shia, keep in mind, the Shia are Iran. Iran is the largest Shiite population. The Shia and the Sunnis, you know, are the two major Islamic factions. One group is descended from the nephew of Muhammad, and the other group is descended from the disciple of Muhammad. It's sort of like if Jesus had relatives, you know, you could say, you know, the Catholics were related to Jesus and the Protestants were related to Paul. You know, that's sort of, I mean, it's not how it is, but that it's like that with Islam. So you get the Shia and the Sunni, these two groups competing with a lineage that goes all the way back to Muhammad in both cases. The largest Shia concentration in Iran, but there's a bunch of Shia in Syria. There's a bunch of Shia in Lebanon, and there's a lot of Shia there, the majority of Iraq. The rest of the region is Sunni. Saudi Arabia is Sunni, Osama bin Laden is Sunni, and Saddam Hussein was Sunni, and he was controlling a country that was mostly Shia. Well, here, from today's New York Times, armed men entered Baghdad's municipal building during a blinding dust storm on Monday, deposed the city's mayor, and installed a member of Iraq's most powerful Shiite militia. The mayor, who had gone into hiding, for fear of his life at the time, by the way. The group that ousted him insisted it had the authority to assume control of Iraq's capital city, and that Mr. Tamimi was in no danger, the former mayor. The man they installed, Hussein al-Tahan, is a member of the Badr organization, the armed militia of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, known as SCIRI, S-C-I-R-I. The militia has been credited with keeping the peace in heavily Shiite regions in southern Iraq, but is also accused of abuses like forcing women to wear the veils demanded by conservative Shiite religious law. The Khans are winning in Iraq.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
From overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Armed men entering Baghdad's municipal building. The Shia have taken Baghdad. Baghdad mayor ousted by a Shiite group and replaced. Are Americans starting to figure it out? There is a civil war, and the Shia are winning. The conservatives, the religious conservatives, are winning. The religious conservatives who believe that the cause of all ills are things like gays and abortionists and people who drink alcohol and people who believe in democracy. You know, well, the conservative worldview, whether it's the Islamic conservative worldview or whether it's the Christian American, the American Judeo-Christian worldview, is, you know, fundamentally the same worldview, that humans are fundamentally evil and that we need powerful governmental restraining forces to restrain our evil nature. And the, historically, the liberal, progressive, democratic view of human beings that came out of the Enlightenment, that came out of Rousseau and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and John Locke back in the 1600s, that was adopted by the founders of this country, is the idea that, no, humans' essential nature is good, and that when we behave badly, it's an aberration. And that the goal of society is to help humans bring out the good in them, whereas the conservatives say, no. The essential nature of humans is to be bad, and the goal of society is to slap them down when they get bad. These are the two primary competing worldviews. This is the reason why conservatives, by and large, when they define morality, they're talking about what people do in private, because they assume that people are fundamentally evil. And when liberals or progressives or, you know, historically the Democrats talk about morality, they're talking about public behavior, because they assume that we're fundamentally good in our individual nature. And how are we expressing that in the world? So the conservatives will talk about, you know, what is that person doing in his bedroom? Is it legal that they're doing it in that position? Whereas a liberal would say, are there hungry among us? Are there naked among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there hungry? You know, are there those among us who are thirsty? Are there those among us in prison who are not being visited? Then we are failing morally. Liberals take their marching orders from Jesus in Matthew 25. Conservatives take their marching orders from, arguably from the Ten Commandments, from the Mosaic view, although I would say that even the Mosaic view was compassionate. You know, Moses and whatnot, the Ten Commandments. But the conservative Shiites, I'm telling you, we're going to end up with a theocracy in Iraq. We are inflaming conservative theocracy all over the Middle East, because they're all saying, hey, see, we told you it's human nature to be evil. Look at those people in the West. Look at how they're behaving. They're evil. And over here on this side, we've got the clones of the Ayatollahs. We have our own Ayatollahs. And they're saying essentially the same thing. The day after 9/11, or 2 days after 9/11, our Ayatollahs sitting together discussing 9/11.
Man, I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do. And the top people, of course, the court system.
Oh, and the top people, of course, the court system, says Pat Roberts. He wouldn't want the courts looking into his gold mines in Liberia, for example, or diamond mines, rather, excuse me, the blood diamonds in Liberia. No, it's Falwell and Robertson. We deserved it, 9/11, they say.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if, in fact, God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Gary, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
So you got to get it that this is the fundamental worldview of these people. This is their fundamental worldview. It's one that countenances essentially slavery, that women should be in their place, right? Put them back in the burqas, put them in the veil. The million man march, and you know, get the wives and the kids barefoot, pregnant, and don't talk back to your husbands, and you know, blah de blah de blah. It's whether you call it Islam or whether you call it Christianity, that worldview is fundamentally the same. And I'm not saying this by way of being critical of it, although I am. I do think it's not good for us. But it is just a simple reality. And in fact, you would find that they would, you know, if I asked Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, hey, is the fundamental nature of humanity sinful? They would say, yes, Eve ate the apple. It's all women's fault. And therefore, they have to be controlled. I mean, that's their rant. And so they countenance these forms of essentially slavery. By the way, on this day in history, August 10th, 1821, Missouri was admitted to the Union as a slave state. As a slave state. Now, you will recall, Thomas Jefferson was, you know, quite concerned about the issue of slavery. People say, well, Thomas Jefferson, he owned slaves. Yeah. And he had been working against slavery for much of his life. This is something that, you know, a lot of folks really don't get. Right? They don't get. In February 27th, 1787, in his Notes on Virginia, he laid out an extraordinary insight into the nature and problem of slavery, and honestly laid out his fears about the damage that slavery could wreak on the nation that he was helping birth. Keep in mind, 1787, this is the year the Constitution was written, right after the end of the Civil War. He wrote, "There must doubtless be an unhappy influence on the manners of our people produced by the existence of slavery among us. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise in the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it, for man is an imitative animal." Jefferson saw slavery as something destructive to future generations in America. He thought that this was a bad thing. In fact, they wrote into the Constitution. They thought that they had written into the Constitution that slavery would end in 1808. It's still there in the Constitution. You can read it. It says that the commerce of slavery shall end in 1808, the import of slaves. And Jefferson thought that that would be it, that it was going to end. In fact, a letter that he was writing, let's see, this was February 27, 1787. He's writing about slavery. And he says, "And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated, but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation is among possible events. That it may become probable by supernatural interference. The Almighty has no attribute which can take side with us in such a contest." He's talking about what happens if African Americans outnumbered Caucasians. In 1781, he wrote a letter about slavery. He said, "I think a change is already perceptible. Since the origin of the present revolution, the spirit of the master is abating, that of the slave rising from the dust, his condition mollifying, the way, I hope, preparing under the auspices of heaven for a total emancipation. And that this is disposed in the order of events to be with the consent of the masters rather than by their extirpation." Fawn Brodie, one of his best biographers, she wrote Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate History, said, "It deserves notice that his phrase, 'all men are born free,' which appeared 6 years later, the Declaration of Independence, has been traced with such zealous scholarship to men of the Enlightenment, first came to Jefferson's lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man in 1770. Before the United States was the United States, Thomas Jefferson was a lawyer, and he defended a slave in the case Howell versus Netherland. And in his argument on behalf of the slave, Jefferson said, quote, 'Under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with the right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will.' And he realized we had slavery." I mean, he had been born into it. He had inherited slaves from his family. His wife had inherited slaves from her family. He thought he could do something about this. He thought that gradually they could get out of this. That they in 1783, he tried to amend the Virginia Constitution. Again, this was before the United States Constitution. When he was in the House of Burgesses in Virginia, he put forward an amendment in the Virginia's Constitution that said, "The General Assembly shall not permit the introduction of any more slaves to reside in this state on the continuance of slavery. Beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December 1800, all persons born after that day being hereby declared free." He lost by one vote. The next year, he proposed a national law saying that all the Midwestern and Western states would have to be slave-free after 1800. And, of course, they wrote this into the Constitution. And then things got difficult, because on this day in history, in 1821, August 10th, 1821, now this is long after Jefferson had been president, he had left the presidency, He had thought slavery would end in 1808. It did not. He was horrified by it. And on the day after, or not the day after, the you know, shortly after, a few months after, the Missouri, or before the Missouri Compromise was ratified, but as it had been worked out, Congressman John Holmes of Massachusetts wrote a letter to the elderly now Thomas Jefferson. This was just a, you know, a few years before Jefferson died, informing him of the compromise, that Maine was going to be a free state if Missouri would be allowed to be a slave state, which Jefferson had absolutely fought against. And Jefferson writes a letter back to Congressman John Holmes, his hand cramped by arthritis, a few years from his own death. Thomas Jefferson writes, "I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you have been so kind to send me of the letter to your constituents on the Missouri question. It is a perfect justification to them. I have for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident they were in good hands, and content to be a passenger in our canoe to the shore from which I am not distant. But this momentous question of slavery in Missouri, like a fire bell in the night, awakened me and filled me with terror. I consider it at once as the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment," wrote Jefferson to John Holmes. "But this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence, a geographical line coinciding with a marked principle, moral and political." He's talking about slavery here, the geographical line, the Mason-Dixon line. "Once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth," wrote Thomas Jefferson, "that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach in any practicable way. The cessation of that kind of property, for it is so misnamed, is a bagatelle," that's an old word for a small issue, "which would not cost me a second thought if in that way a general emancipation and extirpation could be effected." In other words, that the whole idea of slavery to him should be done away with. And the cost of it, he thinks, is a small issue. The cost of ending it, even if it's very expensive, that's nothing compared to the cost of slavery. "In that way, it could be affected, and gradually, and with due sacrifices, I think it might be. But as it is, we have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is on one scale and self-preservation on the other." And then he continued the letter. And this is the truly tragic. You can hear Jefferson sobbing in this letter. He said, "I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves of the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I will live not to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against the abstract principle of slavery, more likely to be affected by union than by scission, they would pause before they would perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world." Jefferson got it. And yet we can sit around and easily say, okay, yeah, and he held slaves. Frankly, he couldn't afford to free them in the end, although he did some of them. But the reality is, as I am looking at my computer right now, it was made in China. The monitor I'm looking at was made in China. The shirt I'm wearing, it was made in Malaysia. The pants I'm wearing, Levi's don't make jeans in the United States anymore, probably made in Costa Rica or something. The reality is, we didn't end slavery in the United States. Thomas Jefferson had to look his slaves in the face. You and I don't. We didn't end slavery. We simply exported it. And as long as we perpetuate that exportation of slavery with these so-called free trade agreements and pushing these systems on other countries of the world, we're going to continue getting the kind of blowback that we've been getting from nations all around the world. And not only world peace will be at risk, but as Jefferson said, the future of democracy. We should be a beacon of hope to the world. The future of democracy is at risk. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Acid rain is not a problem, said a businessman.
No, it's no problem.
But all the fish are belly up and floating round. And there's nothing growing from the ground. Just ask Farmer Brown. On the corner are some activists with picket signs. They want the factories to stop their filthy ways. But the government says it's okay. It'll go away any day. Acid rain is up my nose and in my eyes.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Yeah, the Clear Skies Initiative.
Poison fish polluted skies. It makes my flowers die. Acid rain.
Yeah. Welcome back, my friends. It's 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado, on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm questioning our choice of where we've drawn this line in the sand on partial birth abortion.
Yes, sir.
And I'm wondering if there would be some merit in a liberal spearheaded movement toward moving away from that procedure, especially because it's only used in half a dozen cases a year. Perhaps we could come up with a better way of dealing with the issue, the problem that would require that procedure.
Well, the problem that requires that procedure is that a woman has a fetus inside that is dead and or dying or is formed in such a way that if she gives birth, it's going to kill her.
I understand.
How do you deal with that? which is more important, the life of a non-viable fetus or the life of a fully adult woman?
We do give C-section procedures all the time, and so there's the possibility that could be a replacement. It's just such a hot-button issue for the right. I did want to bring up the subject of the choice in language that we use on whole subject, though, and
yeah.
I think that
Partial birth abortion is a phrase that was come up, you know, by, you know, Frank Luntz and his focus group bunch. That is not what the procedure is referred to. Frankly, I don't recall, and I'm not, and this is kind of a digression here, Jeff, from the things we've been talking about today. But, I understand your point, and I share your concerns. The reality is that no matter what, the right will figure out something, somehow, to demagogue. I predict what's coming down the road is probably flag burning. We're going to probably be back to flag burning. That's going to be their next demagogic issue because they're finding that the sexual issues are not working so well for them. They got to have some kind of phony patriotism. And so, yes, we'll destroy liberty to defend the symbols of liberty. It's going to be their position. Time will tell. Thanks for being with us, folks. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.